Susan Piper.
Hi. It's great to see
you. I'm happy to see you.
I feel the same exact way. I see your face. I see your name on my screen. I just feel happy.
Oh, that's nice. And now I have Harry Potter glasses.
So I love them. They're so cobalt.
Well, you know what? They're very blue. And as I age, what I've recognized is that I have to get bigger and bigger frames to hold up my eyelids. So
let's give ourselves facelifts right now, okay?
Okay. So it's really working out. It's really working out really well.
Looks fabulous. And I love the lavender in your hair.
Oh, yeah. You know, that was a test thing.
It's just fantastic.
She wanted to do her hair, but she wanted me to do it with her. So I said, sure, you know, I can do that.
It really suits you. It looks great.
Thanks.
So I wanted to talk to you about gratitude. And I was wondering if you could tell people just a little bit about what your year has been like, because I will tell you what your year has been like from this perspective.
I want to hear your perspective first.
It has been an amazing shift, because I just remember talking to you, I think it was about a year ago this time, where you're like, I have to change things.
Mm-hmm.
I have to stay home more. I have to figure out a different way to make money. I have to just change the rhythm of my life. Mm-hmm. And you have.
I have.
You have. And it's been very interesting to see it, and also quite touching and moving. And anyway, I just wondered if you could tell people a little bit about your year and what you have learned about giving, receiving, gratitude, and so forth.
Sure. I'm happy to. And if I get long-winded, you just do something really subtle.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah, I think when we met up last time, I was traveling every week, and I've been doing that for years and years and years. And, you know, a lot of that is book related and training related. And, I started my career really working in the corporate world. So I did a lot of international travel. And I remember in 1995, I had been doing a lot of international work, starting an international division for a trade association. And just came back from a long trip, and Emma, my oldest, was probably 3 or 4 years old. She climbed into bed with me, and she said, Mommy, I had a lot of dreams when you were gone. And I said, what'd you dream about? And she said, I dreamed that I was a little tiny fish in a big, big ocean, and I couldn't find my mommy. So I sat with that, and it was 9 months later, poetically, that I left that job, because I thought, I'm saving the world, and I have this child who's looking for me. So fast forward, every 11 years I give birth, me too or not, and so now I have a 20-year-old, Emma's now 20, and Tess is 9. And what I was talking to you about was that, you know, Tess has been a very interesting child to raise, and I don't think it's just because I'm an older parent and really tired, you know. I think that there were definitely some things that were going on that were troubling in a lot of ways, and I went the gamut of my own diagnosis of what was wrong with her, that ranged from schizophrenia to bipolar. I mean, this was not small stuff that was happening. And in the last year or two, I think, you know, John and I think when I talked to you, had finally gotten to the point where more often than not every day we were saying, we can't live like this. We just cannot live like this, because we weren't responding well to her either. And my trips were very, very difficult for her. And so those two, you know, all of that kind of converged at the end of last year, and we started having her tested for Asperger's, which in June of this year, she was diagnosed with Asperger's. Once that happened, a lot of stuff shifted, and I knew leading up to that, yeah, I needed to do online classes, I needed to do virtual speeches, I just needed to be home more. So, you know, the trial and error of learning to teach online, which has been fantastic. It has been, as you know, I mean, it's just been beautiful to do, with the capacity to be home more with her and to really support her in this diagnosis, has been really, really lovely. So that's been a huge learning. One of the learnings was that, you know, we all have advice for other people. And a lot of people, when you have a child who's you know, having trouble or having difficulty, or, you know, all the things that go on with Asperger's or any of the things that Tess has trouble with, people love to give advice. And one of the pieces of advice is around medication. We all have great feelings about this. And I know that I don't want Tess to be on medication the rest of her life, but if she needs to, it has saved her life. I mean, it has made it possible for her to be functioning in a really beautiful way that wasn't possible beforehand. But the first medication was a medication that was for, not for Asperger's, for big mental health issues, and I expressed concern. And here's something that broke things open for me, and I think has a lot to do, mental health issues or not, with how we engage with people. A friend of mine reassured me and said, that's the drug that's used for kids with autism, and it is the thing that made it possible for a friend of hers to stabilize and to minimize the panic that he felt in everyday life that looked a lot like anger to other people. And I got to tell you, Susan, the minute I heard that and the minute John heard that, it broke open a whole nother way of looking at Tess, because what expressed itself as anger, and I mean like fury 5-6 times a day for hours on end, what expressed itself as anger, we then began to realize it's panic. This is a kid who, because she's on the autism spectrum, doesn't know what the rules are. And, that was such a big, I can't even tell you, it was such a big learning for me about how we misidentify what other people are feeling by the word we put on it. And I do diversity work, so I knew that, but I didn't, it just opened up, so talking about gratitude, it opened up a great space of empathy for this child. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I mean, a huge, huge difference.
Sure.
So all that's been a journey, and when we told Tess that she had Asperger's, we framed it in the most positive light. There's never been a talk about this being a disability. It's a different way of thinking. Some people have PC brains, some people have math brains. Both function really well. The difficulty sometimes is in the interface between the two. And then we gave her a book that had all these great people in it who have Asperger's. And the one that really kicked in for her was Einstein, because she loves Einstein.
Wow.
She's walking around thinking, I have superpowers, I have superpowers. And she does.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been fantastic, because what it did, and this has really been interesting for me to think about, knowing that there was something that she could point to as the reason that she has such difficulty making friends, keeping friends, a lot of social interaction, really empowered her. I mean, she raised her hand in the first week of school and said, I have Asperger's and here's how you can help me. Here's what that is, in the fourth grade. And she made bumper stickers and t-shirts that said, I'm an Aspie and I'm proud of it. So she's like full on Aspie pride. It's really lovely. And it's big lessons for me about empathy. It's big lessons for seeking help. Big lessons about following your own heart, about what's right for yourself and the people around you. Big lessons for really listening to the things that people tell you and taking what works for you from those things. It's been big. Really good. So that's part one. Shall I continue?
Please do.
Part two is that because Emma's in college now, we don't get together as a family as much for vacation. So we arranged for a vacation at the very beginning of August this year and went. And at some point during the vacation, John, my husband, couldn't sleep. He was in such pain. So the next day he went to the doctor, and the doctor said, I think it's nothing, but I'd like for you to go for a scan. And he almost didn't do it. And when he went for the scan, what they found was that he had kidney cancer. What I love about the story, I was telling somebody yesterday, there's so many moments of grace in the story, because the pain that he went to the doctor for had nothing to do with kidney cancer. So that came from something completely unrelated, which we don't know what that was, but it was nothing, to worry about. But it took him to the place where he could find it. He had a very fast growing kidney cancer, which if it had grown very much longer we would be talking about a whole different story. So what they call that in the medical profession is an incidentaloma. Have you ever heard that?
I never have. That's fantastic.
poetic because it's just incidental that they found this cancer because of this other weird pain that he had. So this incidental loma kind of set us off on a whole nother path. One of which was what I think you're talking about, and that was, you know, the recognition that after 25 years of paying for health insurance at $1,300 a month, you know, that's a lot of money. We had missed two payments because the economy sucked, and we were dropped by an insurance company. So that this all happened at a time when we didn't have health insurance. And of course, when you have something like cancer, you can't get health insurance. So we were in a place where in order to have the tests he needed and in order to have the surgery that he needed, you know, friends of ours said, you really have to ask for help. I have to just say to you that this is a very difficult thing for me to ask for. I'm really good at giving help. And I think there's something about that that's, you know, control oriented. I like to be in control, quietly. And in a very southern way, but I like to be in control. And I know this about myself, you know, from a lot of things in my life, but certainly by going through a Center for Creative Leadership program where the joke was, and the whole group that went through it, Patty's in control, but nobody knows it. So, you know, I had to own that about myself. There's shame associated with financial issues and with not having insurance, or, you know, an anger at the insurance company for dropping us after us spending $300,000 for insurance or whatever it was. And so friends just said, we're going to raise money. The gratitude piece, I guess there was, and I wrote about this on my blog, the shame piece I just had to set aside, you know, because I knew that I was measuring either feeling shame about it or saving my husband's life. And there just was no question, you know, which I would pick of those. And the overwhelming sensation that I had of right helpfulness by people who know me, don't know me, never heard of me, this community of 1,000 people, raised $100,000 to pay for all the tests he needed, surgery, follow-up. Everything's paid for so far. You know, he had surgery in September, and all looks great. He's doing great. There were so many pieces to that were overwhelming to me. I think because when you are somebody who's constantly giving, and you're being helpful and you're showing strength, it is very difficult to flip all of those things, isn't it? I mean, it's really difficult to be receiving. It's really difficult to be in a place of relative helplessness. Mm-hmm. There's a vulnerability attached to that. So I really had to work at simply saying thank you and not more than that. Do you know what I mean? Not explaining myself, not putting conditions on it, not stopping the fundraising, it was really very difficult for me to do that.
I can totally imagine, and I'm curious about that. And I mean, you have built your life around giving with great joy. It's not been like a sacrifice. It's been the joy. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm assuming of your life, and you're really, really good at it. I just imagine, and maybe I'm projecting onto you, that it's not like, oh, well, I have to give some more things today. It's like pure delight. And however, the converse of receiving is not pure delight. It's like you say, it's shameful, it's uncomfortable, it's difficult, and your life is sort of switched mm-hmm. around so that you have to receive. And I was just wondering, and I've always felt the most uncomfortable emotion for me to feel, it's not, you know, doubt or fear, it's gratitude.
How so?
I just, no matter how I come at it, no matter how many runs I make at it, it's only one way. It is a one-way operation. And no matter how I try to switch that or try to even it out, or yeah. I can't. And that feels very uncomfortable for some reason. So anyway, I wanted to ask you, what do you think? think that discomfort is about, besides being wanting to be in control, because, you know, if there's more than that, and what does it actually really feel like when you stop saying no, 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 and just let it in?
Well, I tell you, the people who were giving were my best teachers around that, because I, first of all, would never have done that. I would never have put together a fundraising campaign. I just wouldn't have done it. I would have figured out some other way than to open up, because I don't want to impose on people. Mm-hmm. And I think what I learned from people is that this is not an imposition. This is an opportunity that you're opening space for people to give freely. Mm-hmm. Give freely. And so whatever I love about giving and opening doors for people and opening space for people to, you know, be fully creative, whatever it is that I do with my life, if I don't accept the gifts that are made to me, then I shut that sort of cycle down. I don't allow people to feel that same sense of beauty when they give. But, you know, I do delight in it, and I love that word. I think I really got a lot of messages from people saying, we want to do this. And they did. You know, they did want to do it. And you know, it was very, I watched a video of, it was called Team Brilliant, because my husband's nickname is Mr. Brilliant.
I know, I'm a member of Team Brilliant.
Because he's brilliant. He has a big head. And his head, but anyway. You know, I think there was a sense of community in that group, and there was a sense of mission, and yeah, I think all of those things are really important for us to feel. And so my job became allowing people to feel that. And just, I mean, I remember physically sitting back and saying, okay, this is a very, very important lesson for me about what it is to give other people the opportunity to help you and to give to you. And lots of messages from people saying, you know, this feels great. From my perspective. So it called into question how I really feel about giving. Do you know, I remember one time a very special person in my life was having a very difficult, this was back, you know, I worked in the corporate world, so money was floating around in the air, and he was having a very difficult time, and his car had broken down, and he needed $2,500 or something to fix his car. And my first impulse, and I actually wrote out the check, was to just send him the money. And then I read something about giving as power. Mm. And I didn't send the check. Mm-hmm. And I remember since that time, having big conversations with myself about what giving is and how giving can be a power act. You know, you see it in politics all the time. I'm going to give you this money, but you're going to do what I want you to do. Or a friend of mine who said, you know, her father gave her a washer and dryer, a used one, when she got her first apartment, but brought it up to her every time he saw her. Well, you wouldn't have clean if it weren't for me. That's not a gift. You know, that's just not a gift. And I've experienced some of that. You know, of people saying, well, how can you afford to get your hair cut if you can't afford to pay for health insurance? And I, you know, and much, much worse than that. I mean, much worse than that. A lot of assumptions about what a gift is. And now I've given you, you know, this money, and I need you to conform in some way to my expectation of what somebody in need does or is. And that's been really important for me to experience. First of all, that we make assumptions based on very limited information. Yes, my hair still grows, even though my husband has cancer, you know, except, see, I need a haircut. That's what I'm telling you. But the kind of, so you open yourself up to that. And I think for me, the learning is I have to be as open to that as I am to the gift.
You mean you open yourself up to a kind of anger or criticism or judgment?
Kind of a judgment or a demand.
I see, right.
Giving you this gift, but I demand that you conform to my expectation of what you should do. So, for example, I got a gift, a beautiful gift from my mother-in-law, and I posted a pair of boots. I posted it on Facebook, and somebody I've known for 20 years unfriended me and sent me a note saying, how could you possibly buy new boots and be asking, you know, me and us for money? I had much the same reaction you did. And my response was, they were a gift, and I appreciate the feedback, you know. And I actually sent her contribution back because I thought, aside from her in particular, I thought to myself, how many times do I make these assumptions? Like, I'm really trying to look at, and all the pieces of this kind of journey with John and with Tess and with this money, I'm trying to figure out, what am I learning, you know? If I'm not having fun, if I'm not being entertained, I must be learning something.
Exactly.
And so I've learned a lot, you know. I haven't stopped long enough to say, right, you know, why discomfort? Why do we make assumptions based on really limited information? When is a gift really a gift? And when does it come with a demand? And that's all really big. I mean, I'm not sure that I'm getting to your questions, but...
No, you absolutely are. And as we're talking, I'm realizing that I think part of the discomfort is we are not built or trained to deal with things that are free. Like, we feel like we always have to earn it or purchase it or return it, you know, quid pro quo. And actually, it made me think of a long, long, long time ago, many moons ago, I was in a terrible accident where I was almost killed, and I was months in the hospital, and nobody thought I would live, and blah, blah, blah. People saved my life. Mm-hmm. And after I got out of the hospital, after these months, I went and talked to a rabbi because I felt consumed with the wish, the need to know how I could repay what I had been given. Yeah. How can I repay this? My life was saved. I can't live with that almost. I need to pay it back. And he said, well, the only thing you can do to pay it back is to live a good life. And I was like, that's all you got?
Come on!
Give me some penance or some, you know, some, I don't know what, but give me something to do.
For 3 years.
I felt so uncomfortable.
Well, I have felt that way, definitely, you know.
So we're not built for things that are free.
No, and it really calls into question, you know, my own giving, because I somehow don't extend to myself the same latitude I extend to other people. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
I give a gift. I give it fully from my heart. I don't want a payment. I don't, you know, I don't extend that same, you know, approach. I don't know what it is. This is a great question, because I think I have felt the same way. Like, how can I ever repay these people for basically saving his life? And the fact, with the exception of a few disgruntled people who don't like my haircuts, I think mostly, you know, people were like, this was a gift of heart that we wanted to make because we knew this story. And so, yeah.
It's so mysterious why there, we know the joy of giving. We have there are no strings attached when you are the giver. And when you are the receiver, everything becomes kind of crazy. It's like your mind speeds up and there's some anxiety and some difficulty. And I don't expect that we're going to answer this big question in our conversation, although maybe we will.
Stay here until we do.
Let's just stay here until we do. I agree. So, and I know, I'm sure everybody you know, because you and I both deal mostly with women, although I'm sure it's the same for many men too, but I just notice with women especially, there's this incredible lack of ease in receiving, and we need to fix that, Patty Dye.
Let's do that. I remember John and I have had these, and he's still sick, he's still recovering, so we haven't gotten to this point yet, but we've had these huge conversations about we need to give something back to, we need to send something to the people who gave, or we need to, so there is that kind of, oh, I have to, like, there has to be a complete circle here. And I wonder if we could see it as a different kind of geometric shape, you know, if it weren't a circle, if giving were a different shape, if it were, I don't know what shape it would be, but let's say that you give to me, as you did for Team Brilliant, and my job was to take that and to pass to someone else, not to you. And that's what the rabbi, bless his heart, was saying to you. So my job becomes to amplify and deepen and share what's been given to me.
Exactly. I think the shape is a through line. Yeah. And it's like someone's back has handed you the baton. Mm-hmm. And the one thing that you can't do is turn around.
Yeah.
Because that stops the whole thing. And I've tried, as one whose life has been saved, and I'm sure you've tried too, to turn around.
That's a beautiful, I think that's exactly the image. I think that's exactly the image.
It's not very satisfying, but it's the case. It's like you're a channel, you're just...
You know, I think there's the whole phrase of hand one another along, mm-hmm. you know, and that comes to me, it's from Ruby Bridges and the whole desegregation history of the United States. But I think that's it. You hand one another along. You know, you, the people who saved your life, then you become, it's exactly that image. I think that's a beautiful image for it. And I think we're stuck in the circle. Like, it's a one-to-one equation. It's not even one-to-one. It's one to a million. It's one to, you know, I mean, I think honestly, the best thing that I can do with this gift is continue my work. Do you know what I mean?
I completely do.
I think the greatest gift is to give to the world whatever voice or vision or whatever my work is in the world. I think to do that, to make a strong offer with that. And I, you know, I love this language about strong offer. I use it a lot in my work. I just did a speech in Canada and I talked a lot about making a strong offer. And to some degree, you know, not really paying attention to whether it's picked up or not, but making the offer nonetheless. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of part of the freeing thing that you're talking about. You know, if you're making a strong offer, I teach a lot of writers now, and if you're making a strong offer to the world, part of your job is to make the offer. Your job is not to read the critics' reviews of it. It's not to see what people are saying on Amazon. It's not to, you know, your job is to have made the offer. And if reading the critics and paying attention to Amazon page rankings becomes doing it every day, then that has become your work and you're not doing your work anymore.
You know, that's so true.
Whatever takes the place of your work has become your work. And so I think probably for most of us who are in that position of, you know, of being handed along, the baton forward is the work that you're doing in the world. You know, it's generosity to yourself, which I think we're lousy at.
Mm-hmm.
Self. Mm-hmm. It's generosity to yourself and a gracefulness in terms of how you can accept things, but also that strong offer that you move forward with.
Yes. And I think that I left one piece of the equation out in this baton thing. And then I wanted to just close by, I don't know what, asking if you wanted to say something to people because it's going to be Thanksgiving soon and so forth. But there's a moment where you're not expecting the baton. You're just standing there.
Right.
And then someone goes and hands it to you.
Yeah.
And before we go hand it off, there has to be this moment of the pleasure of grabbing on and taking it. And if we move past that piece too quickly, the pleasure of taking it, which we're acknowledging we suck at, then there's some that carries forward into the handoff.
Yeah.
So somehow that has to be this moment of stopping and receiving.
Yeah, and that can come in a lot of forms. I mean, we're talking about financial contributions for something, but I think even the story with Tess has lots and lots of capacity for receiving. You know, I've received a lot in terms of how she has really taken herself out of a space of being broken to a space of superpower. You know, it's just such a gift that if I can sit with that, mm-hmm. learn from that, it's huge. I mean, it's huge for all of us to really understand that, because I think we, you know, self-help, which, well, it's built on the pathology. You know, it's built on the you're broken and you need to be fixed model.
Right.
I think I learned from the experience with Tess, that sort of baton that I passed to her, I really very consciously wanted it to be a baton of not brokenness. Mm-hmm. And how much that race, you know, that run could be different if that's where we started from. Mm-hmm. Didn't start from a place of, I'm messed up, I need help, I gotta go. If we started from a place of superpower, you know what I mean?
I do. I totally do.
Lots of batons. I mean, that's what I said in the beginning. I could say this was a really crappy year, or I could say this is probably, in my recent memory, the year that I've learned the most, you know.
Looking from the outside, it appears to have been a year of grace. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and it's been just so inspiring and heartening. I don't know what words to use that aren't queer, but it's just been beautiful to be a part of it, of your community, and to see how you have worked with it, you know, and it's been great. You're a wonderful person, and it's great to see how you move through the world.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. It has felt like that from the inside, so that's a nice reflection. Yeah.
So have a very happy Thanksgiving.
I'll be giving thanks, for sure.
Absolutely. And
Oh, sure, one quote, because I've been talking about this a lot, and I think, especially around this idea of community, I'll leave you with this. It's a quote from Henry Nouwen, and I'll butcher it, but it's he says, community is not a talent show where we dazzle each other with our talents. It's a place where we acknowledge our shared poverty, and we see that as something to be overcome, but as a true source of new life. And I think that's really true, you know, that the longer we hold on to our cleverness and our power, the less community we can feel, because we're trying to dazzle people, you know, with how smart we are. But the more that we're able, as I think this process has been for us, of saying, here's our shared poverty, that's really where we can feel community, feel what right helpfulness is, and begin that sort of baton passing. So I leave you with that.
Thank you. And it is amazing how vulnerability, which I think is another word for poverty as it's used in this context, is the gateway to everything.
It is indeed.
Okay, thank you.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Bye. Happy Thanksgiving. Thank you. You too.